Welcome to Dead Writer Drama, where we talk about the professional feuds, sex scandals, messy public breakups, and controversial legacies of history's literary legends. Brought to you by the American Writers Museum.
Hi, I'm Zakiya Dalila Harris. My debut novel, The Other Black Girl, comes out June 1st, 2021 from Atria Books in the US and Bloomsbury Books in the UK.
And I'm Jennifer Cation Armstrong. I write narrative nonfiction about pop culture history, including the New York Times bestseller Seinfeldia and When Women Invented Television, available March 23rd. The New York Times, June 6th, 2012. Ray Bradbury, a master of science fiction whose imaginative and lyrical evocations of the future reflected both the optimism and the anxieties of his own post-war America, died Tuesday in Los Angeles. He was 91. By many estimations, Mr. Bradbury was the writer most responsible for bringing modern science fiction into the literary mainstream. His name would appear at the top of any list of major science fiction writers of the 20th century, beside those of Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, Robert A. Heinlein, and the Polish author Stanisław Lem. His books are still being taught in schools, where many a reader has been introduced to them half a century after they first appeared. Many readers have said Mr. Bradbury's stories fired their own imaginations. More than 8 million copies of his books have been sold in 36 languages. They include the short story collections, The Martian Chronicles, The Illustrated Man, and The Golden Apples of the Sun, and the novels Fahrenheit 451 and Something Wicked This Way Comes. Though none of his works won a Pulitzer Prize, Mr. Bradbury received a Pulitzer citation in 2007, quote, for his distinguished, prolific, and deeply influential career as an unmatched author of science fiction and fantasy. His writing career stretched across 70 years to the last weeks of his life.
Though his books became a staple of high school and college English courses, Mr. Bradbury himself disdained formal education. He went so far as to attribute his success as a writer to his never having gone to college. Instead, he read everything he could get his hands on. Edgar Allan Poe, Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, Edgar Rice Burroughs, Thomas Wolfe, Ernest Hemingway. Mr. Bradbury referred to himself as an idea writer, by which he meant something quite different from erudite or scholarly. I have fun with ideas. I play with them, he said. I'm not a serious person, and I don't like serious people. I don't see myself as a philosopher. That's awfully boring. He added, my goal is to entertain myself and others. Though the sedentary writing life appealed to him most, he was not reclusive. He developed a flair for public speaking and was widely sought after on the national lecture circuit. There, he talked about a struggle to reconcile his mixed feelings about modern life, a theme that animated much of his fiction and won him a large and sympathetic audience. And he talked about the future, perhaps his favorite subject, describing how it both attracted and repelled him, leaving him filled with apprehension and hope. On this episode, we'll be discussing Ray Bradbury, as you heard in our opening. We'll particularly be exploring how he defended freedom of imagination throughout his career from using his science fiction to point out the evils of authoritarianism, to publishing the incendiary classic Fahrenheit 451, to fighting McCarthyism.
Our guest is John Eller, co-founder of the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies and a chancellor's professor emeritus at Indiana University School of the Liberal Arts. He directed the Bradbury Center for a decade prior to his retirement from the university this year.
In the spring of 2007, the Indiana University School of Liberal Arts created the nation's first center for the study of science fiction and fantasy author Ray Bradbury. Eller enjoyed an intellectual friendship with Ray Bradbury for the last 23 years of the author's life until his death in 2012. His most recent books include the biographical trilogy Becoming Ray Bradbury, Ray Bradbury Unbound, and the newly published Bradbury Beyond Apollo.
In addition to being a genre-defining voice in literary science fiction, Bradbury also fought for freedom of imagination throughout his career. Highlights of those efforts include when he published half a dozen short stories imagining authoritarian futures where nonconformist literature, particularly supernatural and weird tales, are banned. And that's between 1947 and 1950. In the early 50s, he wrote and published more broadly focused cautionary tales, The Pedestrian and the Fireman in particular, which The Fireman was an early version of Fahrenheit 451. He published his breakout books then as well, The Martian Chronicles and The Illustrated Man. He befriended writers across the political spectrum, but his friendship with a few left-leaning writers was noted by the government. And in 1952, just days after the election that year, Bradbury published an open letter to the Republican Party in Variety, and it was reprinted in The Nation, warning against McCarthyism and the emerging climate of fear in America.
In 1954, Bradbury voted against the Hollywood blacklist at a meeting of the Writers Guild of America West. When the secret ballot was discarded for a hand vote, he was one of the few who voted no again. He rose unrecognized to the floor and declared his peers as cowards. The following year, in 1955, Bradbury was asked to put his name on scripts written by blacklisted writers, and he refused. He argued that the writer should be credited, no matter what the political leanings of this writer were. And in 1959, an FBI informant's report cited Bradbury's 1954 outburst at the Writers Guild of America meeting and his criticism of the House of Un-American Activities Committee during a talk to a local writers group. But it did not mention the 1952 letter to the Republican Party. The FBI informant was concerned that science fiction writers can say things that are set in the future that cannot be said about the real world.
So we had a fascinating conversation with Dr. Eller about all of this and much more. I was particularly interested in hearing about Bradbury's efforts to fight the blacklisting in Hollywood, which I must say was something I didn't know a ton about. I actually wrote a lot about the blacklist in my book, When Women Invented Television, and had to really learn. It's much more complicated, and Dr. Eller explains it beautifully. It's much more complicated than I think any of us really realize. We're all like, blacklist, sure. That's a thing that happened, McCarthy, something, something. But then you start to realize, like, was there a list? How did this work? But as Dr. Eller explains, a lot of it was boycotting and pressure and things like that. And it's really significant that you would have a prominent literary voice like Bradbury out there speaking out against this stuff. It's also just striking how much this stuff still resonates today.
Yes, definitely agree. For me, it was really fun hearing about just how much of an OG free thinker Ray Bradbury was. He didn't go to college. He didn't like people trying to politicize his work. And one thing that really fascinated me about him while I was researching before this podcast was that he didn't really even like to be labeled as a particular kind of genre writer. And if he was labeled, he preferred that label to be fantasy, not sci-fi, which is what one would expect. So he just always defied expectations and had such an incredible impact, not just upon literature, but like the way we live and think and entertain ourselves today and the way we comment upon the world's insidious social norms today. And for me, that's an artist in the truest sense of the word. And the last thing I'll add, just as an aside, is that my dad was born and raised in Waukegan, Illinois, which is where Ray Bradbury spent most of his young years. So I always have felt a kind of kinship towards Ray Bradbury because of that.
We'll get into all of this and more with Professor Eller.
All right. So thank you again, John, for chatting with us. And we're so excited to be here talking with you about Ray Bradbury. I feel like everyone is going to be very excited too about this episode. So one of our first questions is, and this is something that I've really been thinking about the more I've been reading about Ray Bradbury, is just what was it like to know him? I imagine a lot of the writers that we're going to be talking about with this podcast were from many years ago, and we will probably not be talking to many authors who actually knew the subject that we're covering. So if you could say a little bit maybe about your first impressions of Ray Bradbury, how did he measure up with what you knew about him before meeting him? Just anything you'd love to share.
I'll be glad to do that. For me, Ray Bradbury is a science fiction fantasy writer who's really hard to pigeonhole. He never followed really any genre rules at all. But when I was a boy in 1962, I stumbled across his story collection from 1953 called titled The Golden Apples of the Sun. And I remember reading that and the wonderful fantasies and the magical realism and some science fiction that was in that volume sort of made me a Bradbury fan as I went on then in the 1960s through high school. Went to the Air Force Academy in college in the late 60s and early 70s. And during my time there, all of the space missions that went to the moon occurred during those years I was in college at the Air Force Academy. So I was drawn even further into Ray Bradbury's wonderful space age stories of young people aspiring to go to space, adults finally getting there, the magic that influenced so many astronomers, planetary geologists, astrophysicists, and astronauts was big in my heart and in my life in my early 20s. Never thought I'd meet him in my life. But then in 1989, I had gone through a large part of my 20-year military career then with operational assignments, and then was sent by the Air Force to get a master's and PhD. And so I was teaching back at the Air Force Academy in the late 1980s. And two of my colleagues there ran a fantastic science fiction conference called Nexus. And at that conference, Ray Bradbury was the featured guest among other great writers like Octavia Butler and Joe Haldeman and David Brin. And Ray was the headliner there, and we were his hosts for a week. That's how we got to know him. And the way he impressed me right away was it was almost too good to be true. Here was a guy who wrote like your father or grandfather in ways that would engage you as a child and stay with you for your whole life. Mm-hmm. And here I am then, you know, working with him, getting him to events, prepping him, but also escaping. One time we escaped just to see some sights and to clear the cobwebs. Another time we went to a junior high school there in Colorado Springs that had been hoping against hope we could visit. And when we got there and we walked through the halls of the school, all the teachers came out one by one and said, "Mr. Bradbury, you're the reason I became a teacher." Or, "Mr. Bradbury, you're the reason I became a librarian." And then an old teacher, ready to retire, came out and said, "Mr. Bradbury, you changed my life." And so in that moment of time, you know, in the 1980s, I realized he was real. Everything we thought he was, you know, like any writer, he could be cranky. He could be very opinionated, but my gosh, he had dreams. And they were also the dreams that we all shared during those decades, and even now in our lives in the 21st century.
Wow, what an amazing story. Thanks for sharing that. He definitely seemed to be very much an everyman in so many ways, but then also so larger than life in the ways that his writing influenced science in so many ways. It's just fascinating. I don't know how many people we can say now have that power or that kind of, I don't know, star quality, pun intended.
Yes, and you know, everybody knows a Ray Bradbury story, whether they remember he wrote it or not.
Right.
And so many people out there in all walks of life, especially in Hollywood and writers, they have a connection with Ray Bradbury. And all the years that I worked with him and worked on my books and worked with him in his house doing research, you just came across people. Well, look, as recently as Amanda Gorman, right, our youth poet laureate, after her wonderful poem reading at the inauguration, The Hill We Climb, she mentioned to a reporter that she was first turned on to literature in the third grade when her teacher read to her from Ray Bradbury's Dandelion Wine. Mm. So yes, he's pervasive in the culture.
Definitely. Definitely. And so can you say a little bit about how Ray Bradbury got into writing of course, writing books and stories, but how he got into writing for TV and film, which I feel like are other ways that people today know him through. I mean, of course, there's that one episode of The Twilight Zone, but then also he had his own show, I believe, in the 80s, right? Very just prolific in all forms of media. So if you could talk about that a little bit, that would be great.
That's a fascinating story. I mean, he's a master storyteller, one of the best known of our times, but his stories of his life have stories within them too. He would say that his determination was part of it. He always would tell me, never be afraid to ask for something if it's true to your heart. You know, if it's a good thing, don't be afraid to ask. You know, in the military, you're not always in a position where you can ask for things. So I learned a lot from him during and after my Air Force career that way from him. But he also said he had a lot of good luck in his life. And so he had written a couple of movie scripts. He had written a movie treatment for Universal in 1952 called It Came from Outer Space, which is a very popular Universal movie and one of the first science fiction movies to be real, to have a scientist and people who wonder about contact and go through the whole mystery of finding the aliens that have landed in the Arizona desert. So that became a quick success. He had had his stories adopted to radio in the late 40s as well. And he had that one film. And then the film, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, was inspired from his Saturday Evening Post story of that title. But he hadn't really established himself yet. He's 33 by 1953 when these two movies come out. And he quite unexpectedly gets home from a trip to a bookstore to his home in Los Angeles and finds that the Hollywood director, the legendary director, John Huston, had called and left a message. He was in town. He was living in working in England and living in Ireland at that time, largely because of all of the Hollywood investigations and all that. A lot of writers and directors, you know, moved out of the country for a few years. And this was during the decade that Huston lived overseas. So Ray went to his hotel the next day, and Huston said, "I want you to write the script for Moby Dick, for the production we're doing for Warner Brothers." And so within weeks, Ray and his wife, and at that time, two of his four daughters were born, and a governess for the girls, went by ship, by rail and by ship to Ireland, to England and to Europe, and to England and Ireland to work for 8 months on this script. Very demanding job. John Huston was a very demanding man to work with, but he learned a lot doing it, and he succeeded. He was able to boil that novel down into a linear plot, largely the adventure story side, less of the philosophical side, and it worked. And when the film came out in 1956, and even before then, everybody in Hollywood knew, hey, Ray Bradbury had survived John Huston. Ray Bradbury had produced a wonderful film with John Huston, you know, in the screenplay, and all the doors opened in Hollywood. Plus, the other thing it rested on was he was writing some great stories, you know. By 53, as he went to Europe, Fahrenheit 451 had come out in its final form, earlier published as The Fireman, then greatly expanded into Fahrenheit 451. So there you have a lot of his short stories would make good TV shows because they were emotional and they were focused and they told the truth a lot about people and their emotions and their motivations. So all the networks were working to try and get him into TV, and there were episodes at work. He continued having his stuff adopted for radio as well. And the film offers came, many film offers came that he just couldn't take on because it was exhausting work and he didn't want to be pulled down the road to where you become anonymous, where you become a screenwriter. So he had to walk that line the rest of his life, working occasionally with studios. Often these studios would publish, a half a dozen or more of his stories or books. They would produce them as films, some successfully, some not. Because once a writer loses control of your product, you know, you can be disappointed as well as be thrilled by the product. But he really worked in Hollywood then for the last, you know, 5.5 decades of his working life.
This really leads us to his kind of lifelong fight for freedom of imagination. I know that he was involved a lot with because of his actual Hollywood work that he was doing. He was involved a lot with, you mentioned the investigations going on in the 50s in Hollywood. This is the era of McCarthyism, the blacklist. You never knew who they were going to come for next. And certainly if you were out there actually espousing the kinds of ideas that he was a prime target. When does his fight for freedom of imagination really begin?
Well, it really begins in those, probably from 1944 on. The last year of World War II, he had a deferment for a very poor vision. So he did Red Cross advertising for radio, was his service, his alternative service during the war. But in 1944, he read Arthur Koestler's Darkness at Noon. And Koestler's Darkness at Noon was an amazing book. People always said, is Fahrenheit 451, are you influenced by Brave New World, which he had read? He actually knew Aldous Huxley, as a matter of fact. Or George Orwell's 1984, which he had read. But he said, no, the original source for Fahrenheit, the motivation was Arthur Koestler's Darkness at Noon, because Koestler got it about what was going on in the Soviet Union. Hitler advertised almost everything he did. Stalin did not. And so you have tremendous horrors going on there on a massive graveyard scale. And in the 30s even, and which is what Koestler writes about. And Ray said, this was the true inspiration for Fahrenheit 451. So from 44 on, he's thinking about it. 47, 48, he toys with the idea of an inversion of our culture where firemen don't put out fires, they start them. And these were just a few tentative pages for a story about firemen going out to, you know, apprehend people and burn their books. It really wasn't going anywhere. But he wrote other stories at that time that were beginning to be cautionary tales about loss of freedom of the imagination. And he felt that at first, you know, after the war, there was quite a bit of continuation of vigilance for the new world that was shaping up, a very polarized world, an East versus West world. And he found that at that time that the first books that were being, you know, critically examined and sometimes discarded from libraries were books about the supernatural. You know, the Oz books by L. Frank Baum are sometimes hard to find in libraries anymore. Edgar Allan Poe's works were sometimes frowned upon in a society that was becoming more and more conformist, you know, encouraged to be that by a somewhat authoritarian society and government that found itself in a position of being a world leader after the ashes of World War II settle. How do you handle that? And how do you handle a different kind of war where the other side doesn't necessarily invade you with might of force, but they invade you from within and they come to get your secrets, which we know happened. But the problem is that a government can overreact and really take actions and take away some freedoms that are really out of proportion to the good work of making sure that there's national security. So he started writing stories like, He started writing stories like, I think one of the best ones would be, to start with, would be Usher 2. Usher 2 was actually first published as Carnival of Madness. It's a line from Edgar Allan Poe. And in that story, it's after all the libraries have been burned and all the supernatural literature is gone. And the rich man builds a house of Usher as a sort of an entertainment party house. And he invites all the bureaucrats who had censored literature away and destroyed freedom of the imagination. And he has embedded robotic automatons who recreate all the horrors of Edgar Allan Poe's stories, and they destroy those people. And then, of course, the house collapses on itself, just like it does in Poe. But Ray has the owner of the house explaining it to his architect. And his architect, Bradbury, has him say, they began by controlling books and, of course, films one way or another. one group or another, political bias, religious prejudice, union pressures. There was always a minority afraid of something, and a great majority afraid of the dark, afraid of the future, afraid of the past, afraid of the present, afraid of themselves and shadows of themselves. So this is now 48, 49, 50. And then he writes The Pedestrian. He always felt that pedestrians were sort of an indicator species, in the same way that fragile amphibians like frogs in ponds and streams are an indicator species. And when they begin to mutate uncontrollably, you know you have problems with the environment. You know there are chemicals in the environment. So he felt pedestrians were an indicator species. Once you start limiting where people can go and where they can walk and want them to sit in their homes and watch their TVs, you know, I mean, it's a different situation than what we have now, the effect is often parallel. And he has this one pedestrian who still goes out, who hasn't really seen anybody else. He trips over pieces of breaking up sidewalk because outside the world of the houses with the wall screen TVs, where everybody watches all night long, outside world is a desert. The outside world is crumbling. In the 10 years he's been a pedestrian, he's never seen another person. And then a police car comes up, apprehends him for being a deviant, for being a pedestrian. And when he's brought into the car to be arrested and disappeared, he finds that there are no humans in the police car either. He's taken away automatically to become an unperson. That led right into Fahrenheit 451. He then wrote The Fireman in 1950, published it in Galaxy magazine in early 51. And then a few years later, as the Cold War evolved, and all of a sudden we had the hydrogen bomb, so much more powerful than the atomic bomb, a bomb that used fission as a trigger to create the fusion explosion. And then just a few months later, as the Russians slowly caught up, sometimes through espionage, sometimes with their own research, and they had the hydrogen bomb. And it was during that period of time, in late 52 into the middle of 53, that he expanded the 25,000 word novella into Fahrenheit 451. And there you have the great cautionary tale. Like Huxley, who once called him a prose poet, like Huxley in Brave New World, Ray Bradbury is really asking the implicit question, who watches the watchers? That's a question that's been around since ancient Rome and Juvenal. Quis custodiet ipsos custodes would be the Latin phrase used at that, 2,000 years ago. But it's the same question. Huxley asks it and Bradbury asks it, and a lot of good science fiction writers ask it too. Who watches the people that run the technology? Bradbury did not hate technology. He didn't mistrust it. He mistrusted the people that control it. And that was the whole mindset. And so he's got about 7 or 8 of these stories that lead up to Fahrenheit and a world where you can ask how things work. But as Fire Chief Beatty says to Montag, the protagonist in Fahrenheit, Fire Chief Beatty says, you can ask how, but she was dangerous. That is the young lady next door, Clarice McClellan, the next door neighbor who makes awakens Montag to the fact that he doesn't know why he burns books anymore. But she has disappeared too. And Fire Chief Beatty says, she was dangerous. She was really dangerous. She didn't ask how. She asked why. She asked why things are done. So Bradbury is by this time getting established as what I want to call, and it's worth talking about, an independent visionary. He's an odd duck. We don't see a lot of that anymore. He's not far right and he's not far left. And mm-hmm. and that's really a key to everything he was in the 1950s that led up to the FBI file on him.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about that? I knew a little bit about this, but not a lot. And I'm sure that's true of other people as well. Can you talk about his battle with kind of McCarthyism in the 1950s and, how that played out and what he did, what his part in that was?
Absolutely. That is, if you found something very interesting, he'd say, that's super fascinating. And this is sort of a super fascinating story in its own right. And I think it's important. A lot of people confuse the House Un-American Activities Committee with McCarthy over in the Senate. HUAC had been around really in one form or another since the late 1930s, but it became a permanent committee in 1945. And that is what they call a standing committee in the House of Representatives. And the main target in the early years, 47 especially and on, was Hollywood. And people were blacklisted or boycotted. Fewer were blacklisted. But if you count the people that were boycotted later, like the studios didn't want to really have them around because they were sort of being watched. There were about 300 people caught up in that over the years. And really only about 10% of them were able to recover their careers in film. Most of them survived and were writers especially. There were some directors and producers too. So Bradbury is into that world now. After by the time he's been at Universal and then working with John Huston on Moby Dick, he's a card-carrying member of the Writers Guild of America West, okay? And that was a target of HUAC. McCarthy was the big voice, though, over in the Senate because he was chair of the Senate Operations Committee. And he ran the subcommittee on investigations, and that was to go after government, it was to go after universities, and go after the film industry somewhat too as well, to try and root out communist sympathizers or outright espionage and spies. The problem with McCarthy and the problem that then sort of permeated this time when Ray is in his early 30s is that McCarthy's tool is the unsubstantiated accusation or reckless accusation or character destruction, regardless of truth. Truth is sort of irrelevant in that kind of a mentality. McCarthy is eventually censured in 1954 by the Senate. And then he dies in office in 1957. Bradbury had sort of been a leading figure in a similar way as Edward R. Murrow was in media, critical of McCarthy. But the Bradbury story is lesser known. It's far lesser known, really. But what he had become was an independent visionary, not only for freedom of the imagination, but for library preservation, for the precious gift of literacy, and for the emerging space age. He was a little bit ahead of it, dreaming about it, and then he celebrated it as it happened. Now, in what he means by independent visionary, was in the mid-1950s, and this was just in speaking notes, he said a few things about this being a world in which we have to be careful how far we go in any direction. He said in this, actually, I'm going back now to 53, it's actually May of 53, and he has written in a wonderful piece in The Nation. He has written an article called Day After Tomorrow, Why Write Science Fiction? And toward the end of that, and he makes some references to McCarthy in that, he says, one reason we have to do this is not necessarily to predict futures, but to prevent futures, certain futures, prevent certain futures. And this is a quote from there that I've used often, and it's such a wonderful quote. He says, consider the similarity of two books, Kessler's Darkness at Noon, laid in our recent past, and George Orwell's 1984, set in our immediate future. And here we are, poised between the two, between a dreadful reality and an unformed terror, trying to make such decisions as will avoid the tyranny of the very far right and the tyranny of the very far left, the two of which can often be seen coalescing into a tyranny pure and simple with no qualifying adjective in front of it at all. This is why he was respected and endured, I think, because he was a voice of pragmatism and a voice of common sense. But how did this play out? Well, in the mid-50s, early in the early 30s, he writes his letter to the Republican Party because he's sick and tired of McCarthy influencing it. McCarthy's not the candidate. We have, Eisenhower was comparatively far less political than McCarthy was, but McCarthy had a big voice. So we have an election where Eisenhower has won and Adlai Stevenson, the Democratic candidate, has been defeated, even though Stevenson drew 25 million votes, which was a large proportion of votes at that time. Bradbury published his letter to the Republican Party and right after the election results, because he was tired of people saying, well, now real Americans are gonna run the country. I think we have to realize that between Roosevelt and Truman, Democratic administrations had been in the White House from March of 1933, really until January of 1953 would be the inauguration of Eisenhower. So there were people who were using that as a time of change, but again, McCarthy and his people were taking it over the top. And Bradbury in his letter says, "I have seen too much fear in a country that has no right to be afraid. I have seen too many campaigns, one on the issue of fear itself and not on the facts. I do not want any more lies, any more prejudice, any more smears. I do not want intimidations, hearsay, or rumor. I do not want unsigned letters or nameless telephone calls from either side or from anyone. Let us settle down and move ahead on the job of governing the country." And, you know, this really, oddly enough, did not become a factor or was not documented in the late 50s when the FBI file was opened on him, probably because it was a very public document. It was in Variety magazine, but pretty soon, Kerry McWilliams, editor of The Nation, published it again, reprinted it there. So it got a lot of circulation at that time. But at the same time, he had written a story that had upset people on the left, and he took them on too. He wrote a story called The Garbage Collector, and he wrote it in response to some early nuclear age planning for nuclear war contingencies. And as they were planning in the Los Angeles area, how to deal with a nuclear blast in LA, I think it was the mayor and some of the administrators said, well, our plan is to have mobilized the garbage collectors to go around and collect all of the human remains. Bradbury said in a letter to the editors of the California Quarterly, "I wrote a protest against a world that can come so close to an atomic war that it can accept almost glibly, almost flippantly, with little thought, the fact that garbage units might be used to pick up the dead in the streets, that garbage trucks could be used for this terrible purpose without any undue ripple in our society, seems sufficient to me to write the critical story." Well, California Quarterly, the editor's staff or the advisors or their board felt that this assumes that Stalin would be as likely to launch an attack on us as we might to launch an attack on him. And they didn't think Stalin was that kind of leader. Well, he took them on. And he told them, you know, you can criticize my story based on almost any aspect of the writing of it and the styling of it and the structure of it, but don't you try to change my theme. Don't you ever try to politicize my theme, because that kills any sense of freedom of the imagination. No matter what kind of diluted thing still gets published, you can't hide the fact that you are killing the imagination, killing our ability to think, killing our ability to learn from the past. So you see, he is this independent visionary, and he's resisting bad judgment from the far right or the far left.
I mean, I'm so struck in so many things you said today by how timely it all feels. It's really crazy. I mean, all of that, of course, politically, and even the more kind of detailed stuff in his work, whether it's the driverless car that picks up the pedestrian, right? Or watching the watchers, which is a huge issue right now with social media. Even something I've been rereading, Fahrenheit 451, and, you know, he's got earbuds in there, you know, and it's just so striking. I get that that was part of his job, but you still can't quite resist that part. And we really like to talk about the ways that these authors are modern and how they reflect on our modern times. So I'm wondering what, given what you just said, what Bradbury would think of the debate over cancel culture today, for instance.
Well, he would, I don't think, I think that he was very much someone who respected traditional values. He respected the values of family. He respected all the freedoms that we have today. I think that he would understand the urge for people to correct the injustices of the past, but he wouldn't really, I don't think, have wanted the full extent of a cancel culture that just might make us forget the warnings of the past, mm-hmm. the things that happened in the past. I don't know if I have the term quite right in my head, but I think mm-hmm. he was someone who he always would say to us, if you're going to plan the future, you have to have a deep knowledge of the past. Mm-hmm. So somewhere things that get canceled still have to be archived.
Yeah.
Things that were misinterpreted in the past need to have an alternative, accurate interpretation today. Mm-hmm. So I think he would have found a middle way somewhere along the line. And the remarkable thing with what you have just said in your last comments, you know, here's a guy who had he was not afraid of the consequences at all, which is kind of amazing because he had seen in his father's time, his father was a lineman and utility man and troubleshooter with the power companies back in Waukegan, Illinois, where he was born and raised most of the time until he was almost 14. And then out in Los Angeles, his father had similar kinds of jobs. He'd seen working class people and labor leaders, you know, pressured by being called communists or whatever. He didn't like that kind of thing at all. He didn't like it when Democrats were called communists, you know. So he didn't like any of that. But also his career, he wasn't tied to the film industry. He became very, you know, prominent in the film industry. But he was already America's storyteller. He had already moved out of the pulps. He had already, with a number of other science fiction writers, he had helped bring science fiction into the literary mainstream. Look at the movies, the Netflix, and the books that are highly rewarded and awarded and recognized today. A lot of it is science fiction, projecting into the future. And he found early on that he could do this through science fiction writing, even though he really never wrote science fiction in the traditional orthodox way at all. He realized that you could take topics of the day and couch them on other worlds and other times, and you could say a heck of a lot more and get away with it than if you try to address the here and now. Rod Serling, you mentioned that he had the one episode, I Sing the Body Electric, on the Twilight Zone. He knew Serling. He advised or recommended certain writers to be part of Rod Serling's stable in the Twilight Zone. But Serling himself had the same frustrations. Here he was winning Emmys in real dramatic TV, the golden age of that in the 1950s. But he couldn't say it. He couldn't say it the way he wanted to say it. Serling remarked that his Studio One teleplay, The Arena, which was a debate in the United States Senate on a particular issue of the day. It was fictional. But that show and that script got so mauled, making it so it was sort of toned down, that he said with disgust, if I had written The Arena and said it 300 years in the future with robots as senators, I could have said what I said. But because I tried to say it today, it wasn't going to play. So that for Serling, for Bradbury, for many of them, writing in the world of science fiction gave them a sort of license in a way to comment on our world today. Mm-hmm.
Mm. And you alluded to this in your last answer, but our last question before the lightning round has to do with Bradbury's legacy. Ray Bradbury has obviously had a tremendous influence on our culture today. You mentioned the movies, the TV shows that are coming out. Much of his work showed a fascination with mortality and the notion of living forever. So what do you believe is the most significant contemporary example of his legacy today?
I think that Ray Bradbury's style, you know, we say he has a metaphor rich poetic style, but what he felt style was telling the truth, to speak the truth. And he said, if you take a story and get to its emotional core and you speak human truths, then you automatically have a style. That's your style. And I see so many writers today in genre fields, science fiction, fantasy, what have you, horror, who of course move beyond genre rules and boundaries, because we all have now, you know, it's all mainstream now. The best of them are the ones that aren't afraid to tell the truth and speak the truth, the psychological truth, the truth about what is important to us. Damon Knight, one of his peers from way back, who is a first-rate writer and a magnificent book reviewer and critic, in 1952, when Ray's story collection, The Illustrated Man, had come out the year before, Damon Knight observed that Ray Bradbury doesn't talk about the things we think are important, you know, the stock market or sports or this or that. He talked about the things that are really important to us, the things of the child that then grow into the adult, the hopes and fears of a child, the loves and hates of a child, our fear of otherness and having to learn to accept otherness. Damon Knight said, these are the things that are important to Ray Bradbury. And these are the things that should inspire us even when we outgrow Ray Bradbury's fiction. His earliest fictions from the 40s and 50s up to about 1962, those first seven or eight books and a couple hundred of his stories contain the core of why he will always be with us. People read it when they're young. They transmit it to their children and grandchildren. He's still taught in schools, hundreds of anthologies, and he is internationally incredibly widespread in foreign editions all over the world. They love him in Russia. They love him in Latin America. He is just always going to be there. And I think he resonates because the things he talks about are true for the child and for the adult as well.
So well said. Thank you so much, John. I feel like I need to drop everything else for the rest of the month and just keep reading Ray Bradbury, because I have had so much fun hearing about this from you, hearing about his writing, his life, his legacy, and just really inspiring, I think, as a writer, as a human. So thank you.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
So now we're going to move into our lightning round questions.
Okay, let's do it.
Yes. All right. So our first question is, which would Ray Bradbury be more likely to binge watch, Stranger Things or Black Mirror?
You know, the beautiful thing with talking about Ray in any Hollywood context is that there are resonances there. Mm-hmm. You know, with Black Mirror, you have a lot of parallels to the Twilight Zone. I think the critics have talked about that. And the use of science fiction and fantasy to comment on real issues. You know, Bradbury had the same impulse. Our relationship with technology was important to him, and it seems to be very important to the show Black Mirror. Stranger Things, however, which has been on Netflix for a number of years now, you know, it's set in Indiana. He was from small town Illinois, sure. Set in small town Indiana. It sort of has a lot of recursive child's perspective. And it reflects the 80s, you know, which is kind of the decade of Steven Spielberg and Stephen King. People, both of them knew and admired Ray Bradbury and were inspired by Ray Bradbury. And it has a Ray Bradbury kind of atmosphere. So I think he would go for Stranger Days. Something Wicked This Way Comes was the favorite of his own books. And you have that in a way with Stranger Things.
I love that. That's great. So next question, paperback, hardcover, or audiobook, which would be his preferred method of reading?
Okay, books, the artifact of the book to him is super fascinating to him, okay, his whole life, because he sees the author in the book, you know. If you destroy a book, you destroy the author. And if you destroy the author, you destroy what makes us human. So books as artifacts were very important to him. And he, as a kid, he always wanted to be on the shelves up there with Miss Cather or Miss Dickinson or Mr. Whitman, you know, or Mr. Baum or Mr. Poe. You know, he always wanted to be there. And by gosh, he found his way there. So to him, I would say the hardbound book. The hardbound book, it has the touch, the sound, the weight and smell of the artifact. But he also felt that audiobooks were important for giving more people access to books fairly inexpensively. So he would see that as a good thing, but his heart would go with the hardcover, even though paperbacks are how the world reads so much of Ray Bradbury, they never go out of print.
Love that too. Yeah. We talked about social media earlier. Would he be a social media guy? And if so, would he prefer Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok?
Well, I've been, I guess, exposed a lot to social media lately. Because our Bradbury Center runs a lot of the social media, coordinates a lot of the social media dynamics for both the center and for the Ray Bradbury legacy. And I have to say, as an outsider, I'm not much of a social media guy at my age, but it just never really twigged for me. However, he would probably like Instagram the most because he was always fascinated by images with almost no words. He once tried to do an early version of Something Wicked This Way Comes as it was evolving with his illustrator, his great illustrator and lifelong friend, Joe Mugnini. They were gonna do a book of pictures. The novel is pictures without any words at all. So I think it would be Instagram and Facebook because it has some images would be second. Instagram's the winner.
Love it.
Wow, that is really interesting. Awesome. For our final lightning round question, which movie director would Bradbury prefer to work with? Guillermo del Toro, David Lynch, or Jordan Peele?
Well, you have picked some incredibly prominent and recognized film directors there that span a lot of time. What I find about Peele and the two movies that it's just, you know, he'd been an actor for a long time. And now with two films, an Oscar for Get Out and other nominations for Get Out several years ago, and then Us, the newer movie, you have doppelgangers, you have doubles, you have body transplant, this kind of thing. There was a period in the 40s, Ray Bradbury was fascinated by otherness and the things that seem to be us, and you realize that evil things are going on, but it's too late. He wrote stories about marionettes, that is mechanical people who would be designed to stand in for you if you wanted to be doing something else. Well, what does your spouse think of that when they discover it? Kind of thing. So I think he would have found Peele's doppelgangers and doubles to be fascinating. David Lynch was influenced by Ray Bradbury. When Ray gave his, in the late 1960s, he gave his first presentations at the American Film Institute, David Lynch was moving over from being an artist into being a director, and he attended those classes. So Lynch he'll acknowledge that he's influenced somewhat by Bradbury, but if you look at him, he's also a surrealist. He's also an artist. Ray would have loved that. But I'm going to go with Guillermo del Toro because he was so inspired by Bradbury's lyrical prose and his creativity. And what del Toro has said more than once is I am a person immersed in fairy tales. That's where all of it comes from, is fairy tales. Ray Bradbury, it all comes from fairy tales for him too. Before he was even literate, he could read the fairy tale books. And del Toro once, I think, also said he has a fond memory of reading Ray Bradbury books when he was a very young boy. So del Toro has my vote.
Wonderful. That is fascinating. Thank you so much. I think we learned a lot. This was so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us today. Is there some place that people can find the Bradbury Center online if they want to get some more information?
Yes, there is. It's the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at Indiana University in Indianapolis, IUPUI. And we have a virtual tour of where we preserve it's an online tour where we have preserved his office. We brought it out from California after he passed away. The family and other benefactors made the gifts to us. And we also have the archives he left at the time of his passing. So the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies, it's on the web, it's on Facebook, and it's on Instagram and Twitter as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And listeners can also tell us, share your Bradbury thoughts with us on Twitter or at Dead Writer Drama. Thank you so much again for joining us today.
It's a wonderful conversation. I enjoyed this very much.